Isn't it funny all this, you know, we're all talking about something that we take for granted. And we're all mad, frankly. I mean, because the rest of the world think we're insane. I mean, it's amazing, really, when you think about it. I think how far I've come since I first spoke to both of you guys. Here we are having a conversation about consciousness.
So afterwards, I talked to her about it and she said, I was in this place. Weren't you there too? Everything was connected. It was timeless. There was all of this information. I knew the meaning of life. I knew the secret of the world and the universe, but I couldn't bring it back with me. And I thought, I mean, I'm like, you know, like Ross, I come from an investigative journalistic background. I go, I've got to know what this is, because this source to me is unimpeachable. It's my wife. She's going to watch this too, by the way.
I'm fascinated by the idea of the number of great thinkers and the great intellectuals in history, the creatives, all of whom, as you say, they've had these downloads, these inspirations. Where did they come from?
The fact that these things turned up validated for me, you know, at least, you know, for me personally, well, I was sick. I was in my garden projecting my thoughts, imagining that I was projecting my thoughts. Something turned up multiple times. So my thoughts were being projected. That's like the logical conclusion I came to, which means that consciousness is not restricted to the physical neurological structure of my body, but is in some way traversing a medium. It's emanating from me. It's going through the energetic networks of something.
Have you ever wondered if your company is maximizing the return of your data investment? Are you collecting the right data required to make informed decisions? Is there more that can be learned from our data? Coeus Institute can answer these questions and help you discover the hidden value within your data sets by utilizing a well-rounded approach to data analysis. Stop leaving value behind and start increasing the return on your data investment. The next generation of data analysis has begun. We are pioneers in pattern discovery. We are Coeus Institute.
Okay, well, like I said, we all know each other here, so don't think of this like a one-sided interview. It's good to all share our thoughts together, because I want to focus this talk towards an element of the conversation surrounding UFOs or UAP that's pretty difficult to explain and raises all manner of questions in relation to what's really going on here. So Nick, your career revolved around the world of aviation. As the editor of Jane's Defense Weekly, you had a position of rare insight into the world of clandestine aviation and aerospace, which eventually led you towards the UFO research field, where you're most widely known for your investigatory book, The Hunt for Zero Point, looking into the world of classified exotic energy and technology. But now, after all of that research into the nuts and bolts, you find yourself sitting on the board of directors for the Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies. And Ross, you've had a very successful career as an investigative journalist, winning multiple awards for your work. Like Nick, you're also a best-selling author with your latest book, In Plain Sight, detailing your own investigatory journey into the UFO field, which I think both myself and Nick have been fortunate enough to have quite close seats to from when you first stepped into the subject. And in this time, you've cultivated a network of sources within government, within the defense intelligence architecture, and now you're being told that consciousness is a key element of the UFO conversation. And then there's me, hardly comparable in accolades to my two friends here, but my contribution is experience, because I've had direct experiences with UFO-type phenomena, and these experiences were, in a way, I guess, currently not explainable through our scientific paradigm, made possible through consciousness. So the point being that this discussion is going to be centered around this more elusive aspect of the UFO presence, which brings people out of a materialistic paradigm and into something a little stranger and more philosophical and definitely speculative. So Nick, as someone who came from a career that's very much focused on the metal benders of aviation, the nuts and bolts of how these platforms work, and then stepping into the UFO subject from the perspective of classified programs exploiting exotic materials, how did this path result in you becoming a board member for an institute that is essentially focused on non-local consciousness and attempting to prove the existence of the afterlife?
Well, that, trust me, is a question that I ask myself just about every day, because it is so improbable. Do you ever do that thing I now do where nothing sort of really makes sense at the time, you know, particularly when they appear to be knocking you off what you think of as your life course. But then when you look back on it, it sort of all interlocks and it sort of makes sense, but only from that sort of hindsight perspective. Well, it makes sense to me now, but none of it made sense to me at the time. So a brief linear time map of how this happened. When the 2017 New York Times article came out, which, you know, many of us refer to as being a sort of seminal moment in the recent history of ufology, the article that said that the Pentagon had, despite all of its denials for decades, been secretly investigating UFOs after all, and that this unit was called ATIP. The details were slightly wrong, but never mind. Yeah, that, to me, it opens the path up again to a sort of, quotes, respectable study of this subject, because I noticed that a lot of my colleagues were beginning to talk about it as well. It really opened the lid on that. At that point, I'd not really given UFOs a whole lot of thought between then and having written The Hunt for Zero Point, which came out in 2001, and as you say, was very much nuts and bolts focused. It was purely focused, from my angle, on trying to square away a tiny portion of the UFO mystery, which was man-made stuff. So I never looked at the broad spectrum of what UFOs were. I was simply looking at exotic technology that might explain a portion of it. But between then, 2001 and 2017, I really didn't give it much thought. And then sort of boom, I thought, okay, that's interesting. Let's have another look at it. But I knew in looking at it, because I'd read plenty of literature along the way, that I wasn't going to get anywhere going down the nuts and bolts path again. I'd been there and I'd done that. And it didn't tell me much about ufology. It told me a lot about what human beings were up to in a clandestine environment. So I thought, let's have a reapproach here. Let's come down the consciousness angle, because a lot of people are saying that consciousness is a component of ufology. I had no idea where to begin on that. So, but as many people know, in 2014, they know because I've written about it and talked about it elsewhere. My wife had had a shared death experience when her mother died. Her mother died, my wife was holding her hand, and in the moment that my mother-in-law died, I was in the room too, by the way, Ali, my wife, said, "Everything's okay." And I looked at her and I went, "It's not okay. I'm thinking, your mum has just died. You loved your mum. We all loved your mum. Your mum's just died." And so afterwards, I talked to her about it and she said, "I was in this place. Weren't you there too? Everything was connected. It was timeless. There was all of this information. I knew the meaning of life. I knew the secret of the world and the universe, but I couldn't bring it back with me." And I thought, I mean, I'm like, you know, like Ross, I come from an investigative journalistic background. I go, I've got to know what this is, because this source to me is unimpeachable. It's my wife. She's going to watch this too, by the way. So, and I thought, I've got to know what this thing is. So I then started doing some research. What came out of that was a novel called The Grid, because I had no qualifications to write about it professionally. But after The Grid, I'm still fascinated in the subject. And this is where all the weird stuff comes in, because I said to myself, I really want to continue studying this subject, consciousness, but I have no means of doing it. I do other stuff. I'm a consultant. I'm this, I'm that. I've got to put bread on the table. I don't have time to take out to do this research. And then a philanthropist gets in touch with me. I've never met him. I've never broadcast what I'm interested in doing. And he says to me when we meet, "I've got this hunch. I don't know why." Oh, he'd read The Hunt for Zero Point, by the way. That was the connection. He said, "But I've got this feeling that you might be interested in consciousness right now. What if I were to fund your research for the next year and a half, 2 years, to go off and do it? No strings attached, just research consciousness." I mean, I am totally blown away, but that's what happens. At the end of that period, this must be by now lockdown 2020, Robert Bigelow, who you referenced at the beginning, launches an essay contest with the title, What is the Best Available Evidence for the Survival of Consciousness Post-Death? And I'm looking at the research that I've just done that I don't know what to do with. And I go, I think I could answer that question. So I give it a go. Long story short, I get a prize. I go to Las Vegas. I pick up my prize. Mr. Bigelow gives it to me. And he says, do you want to be a research director of my new Bix Consciousness Institute? And that's where I ended up to the point in your story. I have no idea. I mean, I couldn't have engineered any of those steps myself. But yet somehow, and we can talk about this perhaps later, something seemed to engineer it from beginning to end that only makes sense now when I look back at it.
This is definitely something we're going to dive into as we get through this conversation, is the strange synchronistic patterns that seem to be within every single individual journey that's experiencing something with a phenomena or something anomalous or a request from the universe being answered. There's a very strange click, click, click into place from the situations and people and places of your life. Ross, what about you in terms of the consciousness side of things? I mean, I know because, you know, you and I have been speaking for a couple of years, and I know you even tried to do the same type of contact stuff that I was attempting at one point because you wanted to give it a go.
Failed miserably.
failed miserably, but that's all right. You know, you get brownie points for it.
There's a mutual friend of all of ours, JP Haig, who tells me that he thinks the phenomenon's trying to keep me skeptical by not manifesting itself to me. Because everybody else that basically try CE5 report these miraculous engagements, and I know people who can do it, and like Nick, I've seen this happen to a point where clearly people are able to somehow consciously engage with the phenomenon. How did I get into this? I got into this because of what I realized UFOs, UAPs weren't. They're not just a technology. And obviously the great Jacques Vallée is the first to say this. You know, he's acknowledged that you cannot explain the phenomenon so simply as just a technology. And it's interesting because what I'm finding the more I get into this is how spiritual it becomes.
Yeah.
And how really at the heart of all of this, there are two central mysteries in our lives. One is, are we alone? And the other is, what happens to us after we die? And I'm increasingly led to the view that the two are linked. And, I'm not suggesting that consciousness is UFOs, but I do wonder sometimes, especially when, as I wrote in my book, you know, you read about things like Slide 9 and the advice that's being given to the Pentagon that there is a phenomenon that can manipulate human perception, that can basically remotely alter technology, that can do things that are completely beyond human comprehension that we would call magic. And yet this is formal advice to the Pentagon. Isn't it funny all this, you know, we're all talking about something that we take for granted. And we're all mad, frankly. I mean, because the rest of the world think we're insane. It's amazing, really, when you think about it. I think how far I've come since I first spoke to both of you guys. Here we are having a conversation about consciousness. But if I can be provocative for a moment, the thing that I find fascinating is nobody comes out more irreligious than little boys who've been through private boys' boarding schools and told that they have to be religious. And I went through probably 12 years of boarding school in New Zealand, and that was enough to push any bloody Christian faith out of me completely. And I've been momentarily interested over my career with different religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, as I've traveled, and Islam, because I spent a lot of time in the Middle East. But the thing that I've increasingly come to realize is at the heart of all religions is the notion of an uber consciousness, some kind of dominant consciousness that is perhaps guiding us, certainly aware of us. And if you think of even the Christian faith, for example, I remember being quite confronted thinking about this, that when you think of the whole Genesis story. Mate, it's got to be fucking aliens. Seriously. I mean, God's...
Hey, that's going to be a sound clip now. That's going to be a sound clip across. It's got to be fucking aliens. That's going to bounce around the internet like crazy.
I mean, you think about it. It is absolutely insane that, you know, we think of God in some kind of corporeal image of a humanoid man. But really, it makes a lot more sense to me if God, or whatever we think of God, in whatever religion we're embracing, is essentially a spiritual being that is in our consciousness, that is aware of us and is guiding us, and perhaps created us. And why is it so hostile to the idea to consider the possibility that that is alien, non-human? Maybe what the UFOs are is a manifestation of them expressing themselves to us in a way that they're trying to sort of twig our interest. You know, why is it that, you know, the great Catholic miracles? I did a story once about a Catholic miracle here in Australia, and it was for the sanctification of Mother Mary MacKillop, who was a fantastic Catholic nun here in Sydney. And I was blown away by the level of research and the care and the attention to the detail that the Vatican displays in seriously, scientifically and objectively investigating whether or not there's been a miracle. And to me, I remember at the time, I frankly admit I took the piss with it, really, as a journalist. You know, this is 10, 15 years ago. I thought, what a load of rubbish, you know, men in frocks basically going around pontificating that they were aware of miracles. And I remember at the time, though, becoming quite disturbed by the degree of care and attention to detail and the fact that there really were witnesses who said that they'd witnessed these miracles. And I don't believe that it's not connected. I don't know yet, and I'm hoping Nick's going to find the answer for us, but I don't know yet what the answer is and how we can all connect it. But I'm not saying that UFOs aren't a technology, because I've spoken to people who say that they are. But I don't think necessarily it might explain actually why we're not able to reverse engineer them all that well. You know, I mean, ultimately, whatever it is, whatever that consciousness is, why is it outside the realms of possibility that what we're talking about is just some advanced civilization that hybridized us a couple of hundred million years ago?
Yeah.
And imbued us with different religions as some kind of cargo cult to make us believe in a moral value system. And maybe they really do hear our thoughts and guide us. I'm actually fascinated by that. I'm fascinated by the idea of the number of great thinkers and the great intellectuals in history, the creatives, all of whom who say they've had these downloads, these inspirations. Where do they come from? I'm talking to people at the moment, and this is creepy, but people at the moment who are contacting me, and I've had three do it now from all over the world, who say they've felt an urge to contact me, and they tell me that they've communicated with a blue being that has imbued them and downloaded them with information. And in one case, the person developed an ability to instantaneously understand physics equations, highly complex mathematics. And I've seen them do it. I can't explain it. But
so they could bring that information back, could they, Ross? I mean, that information came back into the real, quotes, the real world.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's weird because... this blue being thing keeps on coming up. I don't know whether you've ever heard of that, Nick, but I'm shocked by how often in a lot of the literature, because I've been reading the books about all of this, trying to catch up with your work. And it's interesting to me that at the heart of all of this, when you look at people like Nikola Tesla, Francis Crick, who invented the double helix DNA, you know, all of these great thinkers and scientists, so often they describe what they say happened to them that gave them the inspiration. It came to them in a dream,
mm-hmm.
or they had a moment of inspiration,
or some of them actually used the words download. They had a download. And I find that intriguing. Maybe there is. Maybe there's an uber consciousness that is slowly seeding humanity with ideas, slowly acculturating us to the idea of who we are, who we really are.
Well, Gary Nolan is specifically focused on an area of the brain. I think it's called the basal ganglia, which is a group of subcortical nuclei, which they think is responsible for emotion and intuition, amongst other things. And I think he's on the mark with this, because intuition and creativity seem to be complementary in opening up the perceptual floodgates, so to speak. And I think this again speaks to the connection between the phenomena and your own consciousness, that perhaps your ability to perceive it is dependent upon your capacity for understanding it. And so the more abstract and creative your mind is, the more sophisticated of an expression you could perceive without it challenging your worldview. But there is this magical state that you were just speaking of that comes from the creative moment, the flow state, you know, when the painting is painting itself or the instrument is playing itself, when it's an effortless flow of creative energy without any forethought whatsoever, just in the moment. And it's those moments where the best music, the best paintings, the best food, the best inventions, basically just the best everything is made in that golden space of intuitive and creative flow that just gives rise to Nikola Teslas and, you know, Mozart's. And I think it's this strange, hard to pin down, fluctuating, subtle state of consciousness that boosts the signal required to have the kind of contact people have. And I think that's what interests Gary about that certain element of the brain. But I do think that there's something to do with higher thresholds of like creativity or intuitive ways of thinking, because I think the more logic based you are, the more you derive meaning from just kind of the immediate surroundings of what you can see, touch, taste, and feel. I think that grounds you in a world that the UFOs aren't really a part of. They don't really seem to be a part of the material rules and laws that a very logically minded person is going to see as the way that the world works, but these operate in a different way. So I think abstract thinkers have a better chance at trying to articulate this phenomena.
It's interesting, yeah. Isn't it? I was lucky enough to attend for about 3 years a seminar put together by a guy called Charles Chase, who was the head of revolutionary programs at the Skunk Works, Lockheed Martin Skunk Works. So in other words, he was head of the Skunk Works or the Skunk Works.
Wow.
He put together after leaving Lockheed Martin, he put together a series of seminars at MIT. And I think the first one I attended was in 2020, so just before the pandemic. But they were very interesting, and they would consist of a series of people. I mean, amongst the briefers in previous years, I think had been Hal Puthoff, Eric Davis, and others. But on this particular occasion, there was a guy who briefed on a series of experiments he'd done with a remote viewer called Kay Randall May. And she had worked quite extensively. I think it was with the University of Arizona. So her work was very well sort of regulated, tested, and benchmarked. And I remember this guy saying what she consistently found, or what she often found, was in amongst all the patentable data that would be retrieved from the substrate of space, existence, the universe, call it what you will, there were limits. So occasionally something or someone would go, you can't go beyond there. You can't go there. You're not, sort of the message was, you're not ready for that yet. So what that suggests, and in fact, what it suggests to me, and this is perhaps even underwritten by, you know, mainstream science, is that the universe is, or they increasingly see the universe as being made up of information. Mm-hmm. We don't understand how that information comprises itself, but it's information. And I think it does go a long way to explaining things like those download moments, creativity, you know, where we get stuff from in flow states. I mean, I'm really interested in flow states because I was listening to someone the other day, and I picked up on his term, which was frequency, obviously frequency and vibration. A lot of people who talk about the information they access from the substrate of existence, talk about frequency and vibration. And this guy was saying, well, of course, high frequency, you know, if you can keep your mood state at high, at a good level, that's high frequency. If it drops into anxiety and fear, that's low frequency. So when we're in that flow state, we're at high frequency and we get all of this good stuff come down through us. And of course, that's where most of us would want to be. But in this very troubled world, a lot of us seem to find ourselves way down on the spectrum in that kind of negative vibrational frequency state. So,
which some would say is being engineered maybe by certain people to keep us in that, you know, lower state of consciousness.
Well, if you were a non-human intelligence and you were able to manipulate us, knowing that we are like tuning forks that respond to these vibrational states, what would you do if you had malign intent? And, you know, I am fascinated, as I know we all are, by that whole question of, you know, it's the Jack Vallée control theory. You know, something or some things have the ability to control us. And I think that they do. And I'd love to come, I've waxed on enough. I'm glad you or Ross chip in. But the one thing I would sort of like to end on, because Ross was touching on it, is that we tend to think of, at least naturally I do, when a UFO is spotted, it is somehow entering our space. It is coming into our physical 3D, four-dimensional reality. And people say, Ross touched on it a moment ago, you know, they take on a physical form, but at the same time, or maybe a moment later, they're not physical. They are physical, yet not physical. You know, one moment I know I can throw a brick at this thing. If I'm close enough, it's going to go clang. But the next moment, I'm not so sure. I could throw the brick at it and the brick might sail right on through. So what is that? Well, my view, and it took me a long time to come to this, but it is bound up in slide 9, is that the reality we think we know is not the real reality. And before we head off and try to understand what UFOs are, we need to understand what our own reality is, which, of course, mainstream science thinks it knows all about. But, you know, I think all of us here would contend there's a problem there, Houston, because there are all kinds of anomalies on the edge of mainstream science, and we can reel off a handful of them. But, you know, I've already talked about shared death experience, near-death experience, UFOs, ghosts, that people patently see. That, to me, is data, but it is willfully ignored by the mainstream science community because it's going to upset the apple cart of its carefully construed quantum mechanics and relativity physics. So, you know, so we're at an impasse. We're stuck. And somehow we need to unstick all of this. And that's where I am.
I kind of just feel, you know, that this kind of talks back to the ancient mystery schools and the kind of esoteric mysticism that props up in the UFO world, because the UFO itself seems to almost be this weird symbol of symbiosis between the physical and the non-physical, the metaphysics and the physics, you know, the spirit and the science. It's this clearly what appears to be a technological platform, but does things that seem to be, you know, ephemeral and transdimensional and astral, or, you know, whatever, however you want to term it. And I find that really interesting because it just seems to exist on this kind of borderline between these two ways of looking at the world. And, you know, you think about what they were trying to do at, like, the Monroe Institute of Applied Sciences. They were trying to get hemisync, right? Hemisphere synchronization between the right and the left sides of the brain. And so it kind of seems to echo up in almost a symbolic way that there's this fusing that needs to happen between these two, what we consider to be kind of diametrically opposing worldviews of spirituality or logic and science, bring them together somehow. And that's when you get something like a UFO. You get this kind of very esoteric spiritual science that has the best of both worlds.
Well, it's funny. As Nick was talking, I was also thinking about the other side to what I was talking about, which is,
I often find it very hard to finish an idea. And it often, because I get tired towards the end of the day. And what I've learned to do is when I'm sort of writing a chapter in a book and I can't think about how I'm going to end it, or there's a complicated idea I'm trying to explain. And what I'll do is I'll just learn to relax. And it was that flow that you were talking about, Jay, and Nick alluded to as well. And it's really interesting the way that if you just put the data into your brain and go to sleep, 9 times out of 10, I'll wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and I've got the answer in my head.
Ding. Yeah.
It's amazing. Now, a lot of people, I suppose, you know, material science would basically say that's just your brain getting rid of all the clutter. And frankly, they've got no idea, really, let's be honest. I mean, a lot of science really is bluff. It's just an attempt to explain something, and they come up with a new explanation when that one doesn't work. And the simple fact is I'm also fascinated not just by the consciousness issue, but also by the unconsciousness issue, what we achieve when we're unconscious. Because that's amazing. You know, we spend a third of our lives asleep. And if we don't get good sleep, it's terribly disruptive. You know, we can die if we don't get enough sleep. And I know I love my sleep, you know, and it's a joy at the end of the day to crawl into bed and to just deactivate the brain. And I'm fascinated by the conscious and the unconscious. And I'm also fascinated, as in the course of my life, I've done things like yoga. I'm trying again for about the n billionth time to learn how to meditate, and I'm using the hemisync tones. And I keep on falling asleep. I just can't do it. Basically, whatever it is that the phenomenon is, it's clearly never going to manifest itself to me because it just knocks me out. It just goes, you need a good sleep, son. You
know? Well, maybe that's a successful meditation for you, is you just needed to get to sleep. No, you just needed to get to sleep.
When we were doing Shavasana and yoga, I was always the one who ended up snoring, you know. It's funny because, you know, I've got so many friends who had joyous moments with CE5, and yourself included, Jay. And a bit like Jay, I mean, a bit like Nick, I've also had friends who've had those incredible experiences with people who are passing. Mm. My one experience with what you're describing, Nick, is when I first came to Sydney through a very good friend of mine. I met nurses at a children's ward that was treating children who were essentially terminal from cancer. And I was doing a magazine article about it for a major newspaper here. And I got to know all these beautiful little children, all of whom you knew was going to die. And one in particular asked me to be there when she died. And I said, oh, sweetheart, no, that's far too special. You know, your mummy and your daddy want you to be there. And she said, no, I want you there as well. And I was. And I remember, I mean, I've covered wars. I've seen people killed. I've seen horrible things, but I don't think I've ever cried and been so moved as I was when that little child passed. But the thing that I found really fascinating was that kid knew something I didn't. You know, she had an awareness of what she was going to. And it wasn't a Christian-driven belief. It wasn't based in any theism. She had a knowledge. She was seeing things shortly before she died. She was talking to people in the room I couldn't see. She was talking to her granny, reaching out to people. And that's a phenomenon that I can't explain. And it's interesting because I am... gut instinct, I mean, let's be honest, a lot of what we do is driven by a gut feeling, an instinct. I want to, something you said, Nick, about how you feel it was almost serendipitous that person approached you and offered to fund your research. I'm having lots of serendipitous moments. It's really interesting.
Same here.
Ross. It's what Ingo called the signal line. So yeah. Ingo Swan obviously was the remote viewer that Hal Puthoff worked with at the start of the CIA program, remote viewing program in 1972. And I had the good fortune to know him for a few years. And he called that the signal line. You know, when coincidences are coming into your life, and seemingly nudging you on a course. He always said that means you're on the path. You're on the right track.
I have an eerie sense of it. It's kind of weird. Every time I basically want to walk away from ufology because it's just so bloody poisonous a lot of the time, something nudges me. And I had another nudge. I can't talk about it, but I had another nudge, another major nudge late last week. And it was like, it was world rocking. It was kind of like, holy hell. And one thing that came out of it that I can talk about is that the implications of it are that if true, a large part of what's been frustrating our attempts to reverse engineer this technology is the problems with the shortage of people who have the capacity to consciously engage with whatever this technology is, and that you need a particular type of person to operate this technology using your brain and your consciousness.
Well, that is very interesting, if I can interject for a second, because we were talking a little earlier about frequency and vibration and how that is so important in our flow state and how we might interact with energies that we can't obviously see, but which are there. You know, I often use, because I nicked it off a wonderful scientist called Donald Hoffman, who talks about a screen, a perceptual screen that we humans have evolved to survive. We only see what we need to on that screen. And just like the graphical user interface I'm looking at the moment, it's got icons on it. And in real life, I'm not interacting with the guts of the machine, i.e. reality. I'm interacting with icons that give me a sense of the reality I need to navigate to survive. But, you know, what's behind all of that is energy and frequency. So it's interesting, isn't it, that if this person that you've been speaking to said that, you know, you need to be a certain type of person to consciously engage with the tech, that wouldn't surprise me in the slightest, because if you're in that fear state, then you're not going to engage with it very well. Now, of course, coming out of my background and discipline, when I was an aerospace editor at Jane's Defense Weekly, a trade magazine, you know, I grew up at the back end of the 80s, the 90s. That was a massive period of black world investment, of classified technology investment ramping up from the Reagan, incoming Reagan and outgoing Reagan eras. So, and it flowed through into the 90s, which happened to be the time really when I was getting stuck into all of these very exotic programs like stealth and hypersonics and et cetera, et cetera. Unfortunately, as we know from Dave Grush's testimony on Capitol Hill, what comes with the black world is a great deal of engendered fear and anxiety. It is held in place by a system that is designed to be fearful. So inevitably, in my view, you're going to get people investigating this stuff. And, you know, we now... Well, I hesitate to say we now know the technology to have been spirited into companies, aerospace companies, and perhaps even the Department of Energy. I hesitate to say I know because we don't absolutely know, but we are reliably told that that's where this tech has been spirited to. Well, in those compartmented corridors and halls and labs and all the rest of it, there is going to be a lot of fear. There is going to be a great deal of fear, which negates attempts to... But it is the wrong kind of atmosphere in which to bring this stuff to the fore.
Giving off the wrong vibe.
The wrong vibe. Absolutely, Jay. Yeah. It is the wrong vibe. And so, you know, what we are consistently told is that, you know, to make this work, I mean, we're consistently told this by people outside of that world, that in order to make it work, we need to engender an all of science approach. In fact, actually, just not even all of science. Everyone needs to be able to have access to what's going on, because it is not even bound up within science, in my opinion. It is more widely spread than that. It drifts into philosophy and psychology and this and that. So right now, I mean, that's really interesting, Ross. You said what you said, because if that's, you know, and we keep getting told that they can't get the technology to work. Well, duh, it's because you're not engendering the right atmosphere in the laboratories where you're trying to get this stuff to work.
I think, sorry, go on.
Just one thing I wanted to add, and this is not the person I'm speaking with, by the way, but I did see a news article that was touching on the sort of things I'm talking about. And I've checked this guy out with a few sources, and they've said to me, you should be taking that very seriously. And have you seen this story about a guy called, he calls himself Scott Andrews. He's an Air Force veteran who's writing a memoir that Simon and Schuster have won a bidding war for publishing rights. And the logline for the memoir is a doozy, according to the article I've read. He's a former senior U.S. soldier, decorated intelligence officer, who conducted global counterterrorism operations on behalf of the U.S. Shortly after returning from an overseas mission, he began to suffer from life-threatening rare ailments that defied medical explanation. Rather than succumbing, he instead began to experience special, inexplicable abilities, such as remote viewing, and his body began to heal, baffling doctors. As he sought more information about his health, Andrews came across a file compiled for him by his late father. It contained records from a past he did not remember, including documents indicating he was removed from school for weeks every year from the 1st through 12th grades. The records also contained a shocker that he'd received an honorable discharge from the U.S. Air Force and worked in space intelligence communications as a minor, and yet he maintains he has no memory of having served in the U.S. Air Force. And it goes on to tell the story about how he met a doctor who'd worked for the CIA, who I suspect is Kit Green, and he was experiencing symptoms associated with the Havana syndrome. But what's really interesting in all of that is the story of young people in America being recognized for certain abilities and developed by the U.S. Air Force. I'm very sure that's been going on. And I know it sounds like a bloody science fiction novel, but I read about that Scott Andrews guy, and I went, oh my God, that's what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And I do think it's possible the U.S. Air Force has been grooming very young people, like searching for particular abilities. And maybe it's that enhanced putamen caudate connection in the basal ganglia that you were talking about, Jay. Maybe there is something genetic in some humans, which means that they have an increased ability to engage with the phenomenon. And maybe that's my problem. Maybe I don't have the putamen caudate connection.
Maybe you're genetically stomped on that one, Ross. I don't know. But they had the NASA Star Kids thing. That's something we know that. We know
that's
that
they
did this.
About.
We have a glass of water.
I'll be back.
Yeah. No worries. Yeah, so we've had the NASA Star Kids type of thing where we know that they've had initiatives or programs for gifted children, and there's definitely been a few testimonies from some of the people who claim to be a part of that whole Star Kids thing, where they were saying, oh, you know, they were very interested in, you know, telepathic abilities and trying to get us to read things inside of envelopes. And so, you know, there's certainly an interest in that. And while Ross is away, Nick, and I don't know, maybe you'll agree with this, but I get the sense that this is certainly something that I feel is true from my own experiences with the phenomena, is that at the time that I initially, in fact, I'm going to quickly rewind because Ross is back now, just so that you actually know what we're talking about. I'm just talking about, I was just saying to Nick that in relation to this strange, subtle bandwidth of consciousness that seems to exist, it's kind of like my own interactions with the phenomena, because
now it's a really interesting dynamic because I don't really do it anymore. People ask me, do you go out and do all that? I don't really do it anymore. And I think it's just because I've had more time to like really think about it and like also just research and hear different opinions. And over time I've built up a kind of feeling of like, I'm not quite sure if I just step back into that domain as openly as I was before. But when it first happened, because of the synchronistic journey, as we were saying before, because of this kind of click of things that happened, when the concept of CE5 got introduced to me, it was a bit like a religious conversion. I did become like a bit of a zealot. I was just like, this is an answer from the universe. I completely believe it. There was not a single grain of doubt. And what do they say about having the faith of a mustard seed? You can move mountains, right? I had 100% faith that this was real. And so I started going out and it started working. And I think that this is the really fine line with this stuff, which skeptics love, and I understand why they love it, because it's just almost impossible to prove this stuff. If you don't believe it, you're not going to coax it out of existence. But if you do believe it, it seems to be coaxed out of existence. So is it real? Is it dependent on the observer? You know, it gets into a whole messy situation with consciousness and whether it's just a psychic projection or if it's an actual intelligence responding to you. You know, who knows?
I get back to this thing again, which is we do not know what reality is.
Right.
And I keep, you know, it's so hard as a non-scientist, which I am, I'm a non-scientist, to get my head around analogies that allow me to perceive reality in a different way. But the first thing that I come up with is the obvious one, which is, atoms are 99.999%, you know, recurring percent empty space. And yet something turns them, makes them solid. You know, so the table I've got this computer on is solid. It's made up of atoms, but the atom is mostly empty space. So how does that work? Something translates by a process not wholly understood, but it's part quantum mechanics and is part general relativity and part who knows what else into the solid world that we perceive. A world that we think of is made up of objective reality. But I think it could be highly subjective. I mean, we don't know. The only thing that we can be sure of is that we ourselves are aware. So again, you know, I'd just like to go back to that point that, you know, we're all here to talk about UFOs and consciousness, and we know that they're related because it just comes up time and again that these two things are connected. But what I feel we need to get back to in order to really properly study the phenomenon is to study the nature of reality itself. And you can do that in a way by mapping what we know and then saying, well, here's what we don't know. You know, the bits that we know are our five senses, how our five senses map our environment, how we get data back through our five senses. They are processed by our brain. We don't really know how our brain processes stuff. And in any case, we don't know yet, because no one knows what consciousness is, whether the consciousness that we have is going on inside our brains, i.e. it is material, or whether it is non-material and is some kind of downloaded beamed signal from our environment. So somewhere in amongst all of that, there is an interface. And again, you know, I come out of an investigative tradition like Ross does, but I come out of an aerospace and defense tradition as well. And when I saw slide 9 with its reference to the cognitive human interface on it, I know that there is something there. That is something that is key and critical in all of this. It is, how do we perceive reality? Because if you can bend that reality, you've got a weapon. And if you can't defend against someone else bending that reality, you've got a problem. And that, I think, increasingly is where this debate should be focused, because it's A, probably where the answers lie, or many of them, and B, it's undoubtedly where the military and the intelligence community don't want us to go. But, you know, get science in on it, because we'll really learn a lot when that happens.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, I was just thinking of that double slit experiment, and I'll probably screw this up, but there's that thing in quantum physics where, you know, if it's observed, it does things differently from then if it's not observed.
Yeah.
And they can't understand why.
It can turn from a wave into a particle when it's observed. Yeah, so electron.
Why does the fact of observation? And it made me wonder when I saw that story about the double slit experiment and how observation affects it. Are we meant to know? I mean, is that part of the problem here, that what we're doing is we're probing into something that we're not meant to know? Are there limits to human understanding? I mean, I've started to wonder recently, are we meant to solve the mystery behind the UAP phenomenon?
Good question.
I think maybe we are, because they're in our sky with their flashy lights, and they're obviously trying to make themselves apparent to at least a select group of people in different areas around the world. So, I mean, you know, whatever it is. I mean, because that's another interesting question. I think Andy from That UFO Podcast put it up on Twitter recently. He was like, why do you think UFOs have lights? It's like, it's a pretty good question in terms of like all of these red and blue and yellow flashing lights going around certain things. I mean, if it's not a classified aerospace platform and it is something inherently ET or other, you know, what's with the carousel of lights? So it makes you wonder if they're trying to make us notice it, like a little bauble in the sky. So I don't know, Ross, if it's something we're supposed to, no pun intended, probe into or not.
Yeah, I just wonder whether there's some purpose for why humanity is here, and that there are limits to our understanding, and we're at the boundary point of that understanding at the moment when we're looking at this issue. Because I was really quite touched, Nick, by the idea that your wife wasn't allowed to bring the knowledge of the meaning of life back, because my first question to you when you immediately said that she was imbued with the meaning of life was, well, what was it? You know, I want to know, you know.
What are next week's lottery numbers?
Yeah.
But I know. Well, it is – there is something in this part of the conversation, I think, which is critical. What are they? Are we meant to know what they are? Well, yeah, I think partly we are, because as we discussed previously, there is something about our interface with reality wherein the objects that appear, I mean, the UFOs that appear in that reality, on that reality screen, are at once both physical and non-physical. And that, to me, describes something of our reality, which is, if you like, both physical and non-physical. There was a particular pathway I went down in my Bix essay, which was based on research. It's not original by any stretch of the imagination, but it sort of made an impression on me, which is that, we tend to think of our consciousness as residing in our bodies. But if we are truly mapping, or rather deriving our consciousness from some greater whole, from some holistic whole, and that we are perhaps just a fractal of that whole, with, through our perceptual interface, something like, you know, the shell of a body around us, which is perhaps kind of like an avatar, moving through this interface that we've spoken about, which is at once both physical and non-physical, then as a fractal of the whole of created consciousness, we are to some extent experiencing the creation itself. And perhaps that this is the closest I can get in my crude meanderings into this whole conundrum, is that if, let's say for a second that there is God exists, God created this. I'm using the word God because I can't think of a better word. And God wants to know how he or she created what he or she had created, but has no means of experiencing that except through what he or she has created. And therefore, in our domain, the human experience, we are able to derive feedback. We all through all the experience of life that we have, through pleasure, pain, love, death, fear, you know, joy, we are a feedback mechanism back into that holistic space. And from our feedback, the creation is able to better know itself slightly and evolve. That to me, and I always say I reserve the right to be wrong, and I'm not even putting this down as a stated position, but that for me right now is the best I can come up with for the meaning of life.
Honestly, Nick, I think that's a good attempt. I think, you know, we're running down similar tracks of thought with that type of model. So, and it's better than 42. It's better than just saying 42. So, you know, you've already got the supercomputer beat on that one. I think you might be right though, just in terms of an experience framework for something like an amorphous conscious, you know, energy. And it's essentially we are elements, aspects, fragments, whatever you want to call it, fractals of that overarching energy in an individual expression, in an individual journey, going through life, absorbing situations and events and growing in a certain way. And that feeds back to this, you know, this kind of source consciousness. I mean, it's a kind of a story as old as humankind itself. It's just repackaged in different ways. And even some scientists would entertain this kind of notion, especially as we get into the kind of simulation hypothesis. Is the simulation an artificial construct, or is it actually, I think it was Dean Radin or maybe someone else who said this, that the universe is starting to look less like a giant machine and more like a giant thought. Are we inside a simulation, but is this simulation simply an aspect of the mind of the, you know, the source or whatever you want to call it? So these, and again,
we're a God brain fart.
Yeah, we're basically just a God brain fart, Ross. How does that make you feel? And how will that affect the economy? You know?
So all of human history is just one big God brain
fart. Yeah, just a little. Just a little,
as simple as that.
Yeah, just a little fart in the sleeping hours of God. Yeah, I mean, that would certainly bring down certain establishment control structures, I think, if we were found out to be existing in that type of domain. But I honestly do think that, you know, this... I'd like to get your opinions on this, guys, you know, in terms of, like, the UFO category itself is very ambiguous. You know, there's so much within this. I mean, I had experiences with transparent orange orbs of light. Other people have seen giant triangle vehicles and saucers. And you know, there's such a wide kind of pantheon of different characters represented underneath the banner of UFOs, just because it happens to kind of be in the sky. So, you know, what are all of the different elements of this? Because one aspect of it to me kind of almost feels like it's, I don't want to say this in too much of like a biblical term, but like a messenger from the other side, like something that's able to come in and come back and kind of seems to promote ideas about reality that do bring you closer towards universal consciousness. I mean, for you know, just speaking for myself, the fact that these things turned up validated for me, you know, at least, you know, for me personally, well, I was sick. I was in my garden projecting my thoughts, imagining that I was projecting my thoughts. Something turned up multiple times, so my thoughts were being projected. That's like the logical conclusion I came to, which means that consciousness is not restricted to the physical neurological structure of my body, but is in some way traversing a medium. It's emanating from me. It's going through the energetic networks of something. And the fact that something responds to that request with some form of visual exhibition, to me, and I said this to Jesse Michaels when he came on the other day, I said, to me, it almost feels like a baby steps learning program in expanding your consciousness, like a reward based program where you do something that, you know, elevates your state and something kind of rewards you by going, hey, I can hear you, I can see you, we're here, keep doing this, you know, keep expanding your mind, keep growing it. And so, like, I'm always vacillating between whether I should be doing this kind of contact because it might be a benevolent opening of my consciousness, or if all the paranoid people on Twitter telling me that I'm being deceived and manipulated by a, you know, like a bad actor are correct. And I'm always kind of bouncing between the two, and I really don't know where to land on it, to be honest.
Well, it's funny.
I'm always fascinated by those. I'm sorry, Nick.
Well, look, I'll go after you, Ross. I just need to tie a knot in my hanky across my fingers because it's Jesse Magnus was the...
I'm always fascinated by those stories that you read in a lot of the books on ufology where, you know, the non-human intelligence tells us you humans have no idea of the powers that you have.
Right.
And it's that sense that what we are on this planet is we're taking baby steps for a growth. And I always loved Arthur C. Clarke's Space Odyssey for that very reason, that the star child was the progeny of humanity's gradual development, you know, that essentially we'd reached a point of evolution that the star child was the next level. And, I just wonder sometimes whether what we're seeing here is the beginning of a new stage of human evolution, that what we're seeing is a branching off of certain human beings who have capabilities, understandings, a capacity to engage with their uber consciousness in a way that a lot of humanity doesn't know how to do. And maybe what we should be doing is teaching kids how to meditate in schools and doing yoga rather than endless STEM subjects and dull English literature.
Well, I tell you,
I really wish I'd learned how to meditate.
I'm not very good at it either, by the way, Ross, but I do give it a go. It's when you look at the brainless behavior. I mean, we happen to be talking a few days after, you know, the Palestinian-Israeli latest round of, you know, conflict, which, you know, this one is particularly shocking. And it just, you know, then you've got the context of Russia-Ukraine and, you know, any other conflicts in between. I look at those and I just think third decade of the third millennium, is it?
Yeah.
Fucking hell, oh, yeah. Do we think we are playing at?
Still doing this shit.
Lunatic in the extreme. And, you know, I mean, if we are a god fart, then he certainly must be looking at us and thinking, well, you know, yeah, and that's what you get as a result. Because I cannot believe that this is going on now. Through supposedly evolved human beings that we are, and you know, which sort of brings us back to that point, which is we should be focusing on things like teaching our kids meditation, and certainly I think bringing us to a new state of awareness, which I think, by the way, may be being triggered by the increased activity of the phenomenon in our skies. And actually, this is where I had been listening to Jesse Michaels the other day, Jay. It was an old interview, I think, with Jacques Vallée. Mm-hmm. But they were talking, Jacques was talking about how you don't want to give us all the answers. You know, you don't want to give the guy who's needs to feed himself the fish. You need to give him the fishing rod.
Yeah.
You need to introduce this stuff slowly, because that's the way we learn. You know, if you give them the answer overnight, they're just going to go back to how they were being before.
Well, yeah, and then you
idiotic.
You deify the one that's giving you the thing instead of becoming self reliant. You just deify the fish giver and ask for more fish. You know,
bingo.
Yeah.
So. My sort of final point on it was I was just reminded there was a very good quote I came across the other day by Bernardo Kastrup, who I'm sure you both have come across. He's a computer scientist and a philosopher, but he's also another BICS essay winner. And I think he said, we are entering a very critical period in the life of the phenomenon. Over the next 20 years, he said, he believed that we would A, know what non-human intelligence was, and to recognize that it had played a long part in human history, and perhaps longer than that. Secondly, we would know that birth and death are not what they're cracked up to be in our human existence, and basically, consciousness is a continuation both before and after we die. And thirdly, the next 20 years are going to be the most unstable on this planet.
Yeah.
And that there's going to be a hell of a lot of churn before we come out the other side. But in that point, Ross, I think that that is right, that we are undergoing some form of shift. It's like a sort of software reboot that is going to result in humanity, I don't know, you know, 2.1.
Well, I would just quickly interject just to say, and very well said, Nick, I completely agree with you on this, is that, you know, and I sound like a broken record because I always bring this up, but I think it's true. You know, each of us, if we just look at our own individual lives, and like you were saying at the beginning of the conversation, Nick, about hindsight, you know, about looking back at your life and going, oh, okay, I'm seeing how that led to this and this led to that. But throughout your life, you go through these periods of chaos, right? And these are translated in all sorts of philosophical terms, like, you know, the dark night of the soul or the phoenix being born from the ashes. But it's very true. You know, there are lots of moments of destruction in your life, whether it's a small thing or a big thing. And you have to overcome these obstacles. And when you do, if you overcome it, you become a little bit stronger, a little bit wiser, a little bit more clued in to whatever it is, right? And sometimes you have to make a lot of mistakes to actually pick up on that and start realizing and pull yourself up and do something about it. And so I have to look at the way that humanity is right now and be like, okay, the fact that it's really scary, the fact that everything seems like it's falling apart, the fact that there's so much you know, destabilization and division, to me, this has to be like those moments in my life where I was just like, oh, it's all gone. It's all fallen to shit. Nothing's going to be good again. And then it always surprises me. Life gives you a sudden curveball and a door opens, an opportunity arises. And so I have to look at the wider collective from that perspective. Otherwise, there's just no optimism whatsoever. And I just feel like, given the fact that we can all recognize this very recognizable pattern in our lives of, like, you know, things happening that are required, build, that kind of break you down, build you back up again. So I'd like to think that's what's happening collectively, and that there is this kind of light at the end of the horizon at the moment.
Yeah, and
I'm hopeful. I'm a very hopeful person, so I believe in that personally, or I choose to believe in that, that this, we will emerge okay from this. But, you know, right now, if you were to look at some of those things that I mentioned earlier that are going on in the world, you wouldn't think so. Sorry, Ross, I cut across you.
No, not at all. No, not at all. And it's funny, I keep on coming back to that flow thing. I think what I feel acutely is some of the best advice I've had in recent months has been just to go with it. I certainly feel guided to a large degree in what I'm doing. You know, I feel a little cosmic shove every now and then encouraging me to sort of go down another rabbit hole. And it does get wearying, and it is, you know, scarifying at times, doing some of the work I'm doing, talking to people who are incredibly nihilistic. I'm so sick of talking to intelligence people who tell me that war with China is inevitable, you know, and you know, I just find it breathtaking that people can rationalize the idea that war is ever a solution. And I think we're heading for incredibly dark times. But there is that thing about treading lightly on the world and having a light heart and a smile on your face and a sense of optimism. And I do, I just have this gut feeling it's going to be all right.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? It sounds very woo, but again, what parts of this conversation are not? But trust is a word that I keep, you know, getting from literature and from people. You know, trust the process, trust what you're being shown. Obviously, you know, you and I, Ross, we, you know, our journalistic training kicks in, and we are then, it's not to say I'm not trusting everything I'm shown. I'm constantly trying to reference it against what I know and what other people know. But to trust the process somehow, you know, to trust that actually you're being guided to discover things that perhaps you're meant to discover. Just changing the subject slightly, if I may, but I made a note while we were talking earlier, which is, I don't know about you two, but I realize when I've analyzed this phenomenon that I come to sort of quick moments of understanding and realization much slower than I would if this were a three-dimensional terrestrial story. I mean, here's an example. The nuclear part of this, you know, it is very apparent from the data and from excellent work done by people like Robert Hastings that the phenomenon has paid and is paying very close attention to nuclear technology, weapons, power stations and all the rest of it. That data should have been glaringly obvious to me. I mean, just looking at it, the pattern of it. And yet it was probably only about, 5 years ago that the penny dropped. And I went, oh my God, these things have an unnatural, if that's the right word, interest in our nuclear capabilities. And that is a pattern. I mean, there are very few patterns in this business, but that was a clear pattern. And it's something almost rather syrupy about the information that within the phenomenon that, for me at least, makes those click moments when I kind of really advance my understanding or think I do of what this is come to me. And I wonder whether that is somehow built into it, that we are not meant to come to this quickly. It is, I think, as Jacques Vallée described to Jesse Michaels the other day, it is like, what is it, that Japanese koan, the, you know, those unanswerable conundrums, like the sound of a one-handed clapping, that we are meant to ponder this slowly and come to these realizations about who we are and what we're doing, perhaps, and the insanity of it all, maybe if we're lucky. But, you know, I wondered if any of that, does any of that make any sense, or am I completely on my own here? And everyone else is making very rapid sense of what this thing is all about.
Yeah, I come back to that idea that maybe we are at the limits of our capacity to understand, and maybe we need that next stage of evolution to be able to progress.
I kind of feel like, you know, we could be on the verge of that with our advancements in specifically like quantum computation and artificial intelligence. And, you know, when these things start to merge together, which feels inevitable to me, it kind of feels like we're at that point with quantum computational capabilities where we were when we had, you know, massive modules in warehouses with the first computers. Now they sit in our pockets and they're more powerful than what we use to put people on the moon. So we have this incredible, you know, compact micro version of this technology that was at one point in a warehouse, and quantum computers are now at that point. They're, you know, being super cooled down and they're in these, you know, big laboratories. At some point, that's going to become more compact technology, more, you know, widely used in global applications for different reasons, and AI as well. And I kind of get the sense that the processing, like the simulating power of quantum computers, I mean, there was a couple of stories out. There was one even out in the debrief recently about simulating black holes and how these quantum computer simulators might be able to help us develop models for warp drive and bending space and time. So maybe that is the next step. Like the next thing, in order to get past this kind of status quo of Newtonian physics that we're still holding on to for the most part in Western science, maybe the next step is we have to cross that threshold into the quantum paradigm, and the capabilities given to us from that paradigm will allow us to pierce through the veil even further. And I do wonder if we're on that edge of almost being able to, you know, open a gateway, or just being able to pierce through into something where our science changes very drastically after that period. So I think there is a before and after thing that we might live through. We might all be alive to see that before and after effect.
A unified field theory of the paranormal.
For sure. You know, yeah. How would that
I certainly think that when science, get mainstream science, gets off its high horse and accepts that some of the things we've been talking about today is evidence, it is going to, and to begin to look then at how it assimilates that evidence into its, you know, worldview models of theories of everything, you know, that they've tried to formulate and failed to formulate because they can't marry quantum mechanics with general relativity.
Mm-hmm.
That is when we're all going to progress much faster than we presently are. And let's face it, the rate of progress at the moment technologically is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
But it's sort of like technological knowledge without necessarily all the science underpinnings that it needs to be sort of whole and sustainable. I think, you know, we and this perhaps gets into another part of the conversation, we have become a technological society, and we are leaving behind that aspect of us that is spiritual. You know, we've talked about that earlier in this show. And you know, you can go back to the roots of that, you know, Descartes separating mind and body, and church and state separating, you know, science and religion 300 odd years ago. To my mind, we have to find a way of bringing spirit back into our worldview in a way that we are not at the moment. Mm. And that is giving us all the problems we have, you know, accelerating AI. I recently saw the Oppenheimer movie. I'm sure you guys have too. The resonances there with, you know, what Oppenheimer was doing and his scientific team, where they have a problem in which there is a small chance they might blow up the world, but they cannot stop themselves from going to the end of the line and finding out what happens when they press the red button. And it's the same with AI. We, science, the military, call it what you will, cannot stop itself, ourselves, from seeing what is at the end of the line, even though it might kill us, which, again, to me, is a sign of distinct insanity in society. And we've just got to find a way of pulling that back. And, you know, there are spin-offs from that. Mental health. You know, we have a mental health pandemic in the world where it is rampant. There are all kinds of reasons for that, of course, but there is a lot of anxiety in the world. We've talked about that. But again, I think it's, you know, that separation from sort of body and spirit. You know, we've put a focus on our physical appearance. We've put a focus on longevity and extending our lives, but we haven't paid any attention to the spiritual side of us. And yet, then look what happens when people experiment with things like microdoses of psilocybin, which seems to have an incredibly positive effect on people who have suffered terribly from, you know, longstanding mental health issues. That's a bit of a rant and a rave, but it's just to say that I think there is a sort of reintegration of us that is critical right now. And as Bernardo Kastrup said, we have at best 20 years in which to achieve it.
Well, this is kind of what I've termed as techno-shamanism, right? Is that I kind of think that we are, like you said, we're a technological species, and we're clearly technocentric for the most part, and that's where we're going as an evolutionary dynamic. So we have to imagine it's either an error, like an evolutionary fuck up, and we're going to just spiral down into destroying ourselves, or it's an expression of a revolution, which obviously creates a lot of turbulence, but is actually streamlining our ability through evolution. And so technology might be the medium through which we bring that spirituality back by, like I said, if we develop sufficient enough abilities to kind of almost pierce through that veil in a scientific way. So instead of the shaman sitting in the tent communing with the spirits, it's the scientist going, hey, I've tapped into an alternative dimension, and there's other intelligences in this dimension, and here's the proof of it. And so, like, I think that might be where we go, is this kind of melding between science and spirit. It's not about going all the way back to the trees and the jungles and the ayahuasca, and like we're long past that point of humanity's evolution. We are a technological species, and if we don't destroy ourselves, we are going into space. And so it would seem to me that And again, the UFO seems to echo this reflection of, you know, symbiosis between spirit and science. So it kind of feels to me that we might be approaching that point where technology looks back into the spiritual, you know, kind of underpinnings of existence and provides evidence for it. Imagine if we actually live in a time where scientific evidence for spiritual kind of underpinnings becomes the consensus.
Well, I certainly think there's something wrong with the scientific hypothesis. I find the dogmaticism of science just so frustrating, because, you know, they purport to speak for objective analysis, and yet they deny witness evidence. And that experiential witness evidence, to me, is absolutely fundamental to an understanding of the phenomenon. And, I mean, Nick and I, as journalists, we interview witnesses and base stories around them and weigh evidence up, as courts do, to make an assessment about whether or not something can be believed. And yet science is quite disdainful of witness evidence. And I've always, when I wrote my book, I was really struck by the idea that at the heart of the problem with even beginning to understand the phenomenon is the only real data in most cases comes from people who are claiming to have had an experience. But why do we reject that experience? If somebody says that they've been beamed aboard a spaceship or had an encounter with a non-human intelligence, why is it dismissed out of hand? You know, I think we all do it. You know, we all basically go, well, that's not real data. Why?
I mean, you're so right, Ross, because, you know, and actually, this is where not being a scientist, for me, and perhaps you too, is an advantage.
Yeah.
Because if I were a scientist, I'd be looking down a straw at my particular branch of science, and I'd be saying, no. What they're talking about is impossible. So I'm just going to ignore it completely, which is the dogmatism of science, which, like you, drives me flipping bananas.
Yeah.
Because it's so short-sighted, because actually what we are confronted with, you and me and all of us, is data. And the data is, you can correlate that data. It maps across multiple different experiences and domains. And if you were to take that data into a court of law and go, we're going to convict this thing on the evidence, and you produce all of that data and the way it maps across individual experiences in different parts of the world. Yes, of course, it is not always going to conform, because there's something bloody squirrely going on in the translation process between the five dimensions where it is largely happening and our own 3 and 4D dimensional space, which is going to twist and bend that data out of shape. But still, it maps in a convincing way, enough for me to go to jury and go, do you, on the strength of what you've heard, convict this thing and make it real? And any sensible jury would go, yes. But meantime, there is the lone dogmatic voice of mainstream science going, nah, I don't know what you're talking about. It's all just hearsay, weird, and ignorable.
Yeah, I believe Jesse Michaels referred to these guys as the intellectual midwits of science, and I think that's very true. Or the the average lab coat Joes, because they're not the brilliant Teslas or Einsteins of the kind of abstract thinking scientific world. They're the kind of the congressional crowd around the doctrine of the time, around that they've gone through a very specific academic avenue. So, you know, your Neil deGrasse Tysons and your Brian Coxes and, you know, Carl Sagan's, like, they were all brilliant people in their own way, in their own field, but they are refined academically into a kind of consensus perspective. And I think going back to what you said as well, Ross, about the disbelief level, like, why do people not believe this stuff? I think an interesting component of being an experiencer of UFO phenomena is that ridicule factor, because often it would seem, in like the most direct face-to-face cases of being exposed to, you know, either the vehicles or the occupants within them, or these forms like the orbs that I witnessed, there will be components in the story that, if told, will add layers of disbelief to what many consider already to be a hard-to-believe story. And I find this interesting because I wonder if it's purposeful, that the experiences themselves are so bizarre and done in a way that doesn't really allow for proof to be gathered sufficiently, that this in of itself automatically covers up their existence because most people just don't believe what they're hearing from someone who claims an experience. So I wonder if that is a component, if that's... Is it just a bio effect of their nature, which we find really strange, or are they purposefully presenting themselves in a way that's so strange? If you tell people about it, most people will just think you're crazy.
Well, if it's a way for the consciousness to seed the universe by making people more aware of it, it's not really succeeding very well, is it? Because we're fighting the trench warfare in Western Europe, we're failing at the moment.
I mean, unless it can see a bigger picture,
a little bit more overt.
Unless it can see a bigger picture as an omnipotent thing beyond time. And it's like, well, these things are necessary components, a bit like the building blocks in our own lives where we go, oh, everything's falling apart. And then 2 years later, you go, oh, that falling apart was needed. So on the world scale, maybe it recognizes, well, these things have to happen. These conflicts, these evolutionary breakages, going back to what I think both of you said about kind of interventionism, like how much of an intervention do they have on our world? Well, if you intervene too much, you become gods and they don't evolve properly. Like we have to fall over in the playground. We have to bump our knees and burn our finger in the fire. And so maybe that's what is happening, because a lot of people say, well, if they control our nuclear assets, why didn't they stop Hiroshima and Nagasaki? And it's like, it's a valid point, but maybe there is a reason why certain things can't be just intervened in and we have to make catastrophic mistakes as a species in order to, get past them and grow. So it's difficult to know what kind of control really is being levied by this phenomena on humanity.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one that, I mean, there's part of me that says what we are experiencing is everything everywhere all at once. So this, our lives play out over however many years we're lucky to have on the planet. And it plays out linearly. But, there is an argument for saying that actually what is happening is just happening all now in some other dimensional space. And we just witness it and experience it in the linear way that we do. So part of me thinks like that, but there's another part of me that says, well, if this is a simulation, and by the way, that simulation, of course, could still play out in the way that I've just described, being everything everywhere all at once, but us just experiencing it in a sort of linear fashion.
Yeah.
But if we are living in a simulation, you've got to let the simulation play out. But occasionally, there may be things in the simulated game that you hadn't quite factored in. And I can't quite see how this could be, but I'm still persuaded by it somewhat. And something tells me that nuclear technology was sort of that thing that, oh my God, the kids found in a corner of the playground a box of matches they were never meant to find. But in some glitch in the program, they did. And oh my God, they've struck a few matches. We don't like the look of that. And even worse, it has some ripple effect into our own cosmological space. And that's not doing us any good either. So we've got to go and nudge the kids back onto course. And maybe we flip time back a little bit and we just rewind the clock a little bit so that... And let's hope the destructive potential of that box of matches, now, of course, transliterated into nuclear weapons, doesn't actually play out in the way that this new simulation would go. So somewhere in that sort of space is sort of where I'm at the moment. So we have free will, but at the same time, there is stuff that I think we may not have been supposed to have found.
But I think we have to acknowledge that there are some things, there's a limit to our capacity for understanding. And I think it's possibly why the attempt to master this technology may be futile. And maybe that's why the phenomenon is becoming more overt and manifesting itself, because it's sick of those in the human race who've been concealing it for so long, trying to conceal it. Maybe it's making itself more overt because it thinks we have a right to know about it.
Yeah, well, I don't know if we figured anything out, but we certainly talked a lot about it. So, you know, we're getting there, baby steps. I want to be conscious of the time because I know it's creeping up on you now in Australia, Ross. So we've gone for an hour and a half. I think we've covered some interesting intellectual ground. If there's anything either of you want to bring up before we wrap up, we can do so. If not, we can wind it down.
I'm pretty good, to be honest.
Yeah, me too.
Nothing to promote. I mean, well, Ross, you had a book come out recently. You had a rewrite of the In Plain Sight book.
Oh, yeah, the latest edition of In Plain Sight is out right now, actually. And I'm also doing a special this weekend on News Nation, the US cable TV network. We're taking a very close look at the real story about the February shootdowns, the still unexplained shootdowns of three objects over North America. Watch this space.
I am looking forward to that one. Like you, I've gone mental about how our profession has fallen down on that job. For me, that is a story with real footprints that is begging to be investigated and yet disgracefully has not been, by the community you'd hope would really get its teeth into it. So I can't wait for that episode. I'll watch it with great interest.
You and me both. And Nick, before we go, now you might have just subtly put this into the conversation without me realizing, but when I first spoke to you, you did say in the messages that you had a few things you wanted to say that you hadn't really said publicly before. Have you said those things, or can you say them now?
I've probably seeded some of them, Jay. Actually, no, I do have some. I will soon have some news of a tangible, physical nature that I am really looking forward to sharing. Not quite there yet, but I will be soon. And that's going to be an exciting time. And I hope you'll have me back on the show if I haven't completely exhausted all of my intellectual capacity to spout stuff at 10, 11 o'clock in the morning.
Well, you've done a very good job at spouting away at 10 o'clock in the morning. You and me both, I am not a morning person. As you both know, Ross knows this as well, I am not a morning person, but whenever I get into a conversation with people like you and it's on this kind of, narrative and vibe, the energy just comes straight up. So this has been great, guys. Links will be in the description box below for anyone who wants to check out, obviously, the Need to Know podcast by Ross, Twitter for Nick Kirk in the books. So check the description box below. If you can support us on Patreon, that's really appreciated. And you do get access to our private Discord server and early access of all of the content like this. So thank you so much, guys, for taking part today. It's been really good. Really enjoyed it.